Barbie's going camping out west, and she's not alone. She's taking all her friends in her motor home.
Barbie Golden Dream Motor Home.
There's a whole house inside.
Set the table with Golden Ooh. Isle Barbecue.
Wow.
We'll have a fancy party and a sleepover too.
Cool car.
Pile in, and we're gone.
Wow.
So much to do.
Awesome.
Fun goes on and on. Barbie Golden Dream Motor Home.
Golden Dream Motor Home with bedroom, kitchen, and dining area. You put it together, dolls and fashion sold separately.
Coming up in today's podcast, there's been in total 201 goal kickers at the wire, but which one's the best? We go in search of their Area 51 files. Toronto becomes an embarrassing cock-up, you voted on should they return. Daniel picks his starting 13 for August the 8th, as Dennis redesigns the oval-shaped ball. Rimmer's Lot lays down the red carpet, but Stevie rubs Balding up the wrong way, and the Warrington players resume training, all COVID-free. Not long to go now, everyone. This is What Would Brian Bevan Say?
Hello, I'm Rob London, and I'm pleased to say with the players back at Padgate training, I too have new trainers. Yes, a lovely sole pair of Dunlop Green Flash. But never mind my sole trainers, where are my podcasting soulmates? Firstly, he exercises every morning, stretching his statistical torso before breakfasting on a factual numerical blended smoothie of Warrington Wolves statistics. It's Sam Wick Sankey.
Hello, Robert. High tech. They were my first proper, what I would call posh trainers. From Ward Sports on Ryland Street. Before that, it was just the black pumps that you got to do PE off the market.
Oh, yeah.
And football boots were Gola. I had a pair of Gola football boots. I remember them.
Cross country, mate, at Tatton Park in a pair of Dunlop Green Flash. And they came off on the first bend. I should have carried on like Zola Budd, but I went back and picked them up in the mud. And also, he hasn't exercised since 1989, when he was chased from the Polybop Disco at Leeds University by some bloke wielding a 10-inch knife. It's Dennis, type 2 diabetes, Waywell.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for that.
How are you, mate?
That's complete nonsense, isn't it, really? It wasn't a 10-inch knife, it was about an 8-inch knife. The rest of it's true. I feel like I've got diabetes.
You got away though, mate, didn't you?
I did get away. Yeah, I had some suede shoes on. It was like that was like running with Zola Budd.
Jack O'Nory, Jack O'Nory. Jack O'Nory.
Hello. The story I'm going to tell you this week is called Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim.
We'll start, well, we had to start with it, didn't we, lads? I mean, it's just been all over the press. Toronto Wolfpack are no longer there. They have resigned to the fact that they're not going to be in the competition in 2020 anymore. Sam, I'll start with you, mate. Just to summarise it, I guess, first, what's your feelings on this?
Well, we talked about it last week, didn't we?
And we talk about it every week, don't we? Every week we talk about bloody Toronto.
But we said we thought it was going to be make or break. What we didn't necessarily think when we were talking on Sunday lunchtime was that by Monday lunchtime it was break. It would appear that even though they have a consortium running it, it appeared that it's basically David Argyle said, stuff it. As much as I can understand or think I can understand the reasoning, to have done it then, when for the last 2 weeks they've obviously been talking behind closed doors about fixtures and everything, just seems wrong. Why didn't they do it 2 weeks ago?
Right. Strange. So that's where your qualm is it? It's the fact that they just didn't do it quick enough.
I do have some sympathy for Toronto. They were allowed into the competition 4 years ago. So having been allowed in, they should get full rights like everyone else. But they get no Sky money, no RFL loan. They get no furlough, because obviously they're not in this country. They get no vote on the Super League board. So I get the feeling he said, well, you know what, stuff it. it's going to cost us too much to complete this season.
He is a billionaire, Sam.
Well, I appreciate that.
Is a billionaire really going to be concerned about whether he's got £300,000 or not off the Super League?
It's whether they feel it's there and whether they feel it is worth doing. What it does bring hugely into doubt, in my opinion, is their participation next year. Because if David Argyle says, you know what, I'll put up £5 million for 2021, just let us back in, lads. I don't think they're just going to be let back in that easily, are they?
Well, yeah. Maybe it's because he's owed £10 million by the government of Nauru. Maybe that's probably what the problem is there. Apparently, they're not paying up.
Dennis, are you sort of happy to see them go now? Are you sort of want to put this behind us and we'll just move on and forget all about Toronto, or would you like to see them back?
I think they should go. I'm not a big fan of this, expansion thing. I just don't think it works in this modern day. I mean, I know you can say, oh, well, everywhere's closer and what have you, but everything is always going to, we've said it before, whether it's a volcano, terrorism, as in this now, you know, a pandemic, it just disrupts everything. There's too many things to go around with, like air travel between things. I know they do it all the time in Australia and everything, but you know, there's no money really to support it here. It's not enjoyable going to a stadium over here and then having no away fans and stuff. It ruins the experience to that point.
No, I think you're outdated there in so much that I agree that it is better when there's an atmosphere in the stadium. I agree that, and away fans create that. Yes. However, London don't bring any. Catalan don't bring any. On a Friday night, Salford.
You're just comparing. That's not an answer.
Well, they don't bring any. So
it's not an answer. You're just comparing.
So kick them out.
My question was clearly, it ruins it for the fans. Now, the change needs to be is how can you increase that atmosphere of away fans and focus on where...
Toronto, clearly causing disruption on the podcast. Sorry, Kerry.
Why don't you develop the fan base?
Do apologise to all the listeners in regards to this.
And then they can actually get to the game.
There will be an internal investigation as to why this is carrying on.
It's no good just saying like,
my apologies as they carry on.
Pointless.
My apologies.
But Dennis has got a point. But the point is... The point is, if we cared about that, and they obviously don't at Super League board level, everyone would be playing on a Sunday afternoon with only one game on a Friday on TV.
Mm. Yeah. What's wrong, Dennis? What's wrong with you at the moment? You've had a bad week, haven't you? What's wrong, mate?
No. I think it's important, and Sam's just actually nailed it on that bit, is the fact that you know, it should be about what you want to create as a sport, and rather than trying to sort of go for this sort of like golden ticket, bloody thousands of miles away. And actually, what you want to do is sort of, you know, get back to sort of like building the game up again with a big fan base. I think that's really important.
Toronto's coming between us all.
It has, hasn't it?
It's like a girl we're all fighting over.
If we move on from that, Toronto have gone. Let's assume that they are at the very least relegated, i.e. demoted and not allowed back in next year. And if they're going in, they've got to come from the Championship again. Who are you going to promote? Because there's no competition in the Championship this year, is there?
Oh, he's good, isn't he? He's good, Sankey, isn't he? He's come out with
Or are they suddenly going to make this new competition that the detail we've not had yet in November and December, winners of that go up?
If Toronto do become a success, and I don't think they will, but as Dennis has said, they've got a billionaire behind them, so as much money as he wants to throw at them will continue until he says goodbye. I think they are just purely using Super League as a stepping stone to enter the NRL. And then how are we all going to feel about that when they run around in Super League for 3 years and then disappear to the NRL? How are we going to feel about that? We asked the listeners what they thought. Should Toronto be allowed back into Super League in 2021, we had four options. A, yes. B, no. C, no. Or D, no. 63.7% went for no. Dennis, you happy with that?
Well, I looked at that. It was a good survey, another psychological survey that you put together there.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, 36.3%. So let's look at the B, C, and D options of no, no, or no? So B, no, was somebody who is emphatically demonstrating that they don't want to have them in there, because that was the second option.
Yes.
The third option was the considered group, which obviously made took it all into account, this, that, and the other, and they concluded that that would be no. Or the no at the end, they were just basically unsure and didn't give a fuck and thought they'd just put no. So, yeah, overall, I think, you know, two-thirds of the people agree with what we were saying. Yeah, get rid of them.
Okay, well, with Toronto gone, we've had a different league table come out this week, lads. Warrington have dropped two places down to sixth. The table now reads as Wigan played 6, won 2, 1-4, lost 2. They're still on 8 points. Castleford are also on 8 points with 4 wins. Huddersfield are also on 8 points with 4 wins. And then we've got Leeds, Catalans, Warrington and Hull all on 6 points. Warrington are down in 6 because they've only got a plus 2 goal difference. And then lo and behold, Saints are down in 8th place with only 4 points, the same as Wakefield. Salford in 10th with 2 and also Hull KR on 2 points as well. Doesn't really change the table, really, does it? Because, you know, Toronto now are obsolete, so it's all going to be the same for everyone else still. It just possibly shows that we'd played Toronto and a few other teams hadn't, Sam.
Yes, and we've unfortunately lost a win, haven't we? Whereas other teams, at, Huddersfield in particular, come out of it well, don't they? Only lost one game.
So the table's nearly sort of showing exactly what we were predicting the other week, because we said that Warrington are effectively in seventh. So if, like, you know, because Saints have got two games, if they win one, they'll go above us. And so, yeah, we're seventh.
Yeah, it's really one of the games in hand gone, isn't it?
What I think it does really show is you know, we've all gone on about, oh, we'd won 4, we'd lost 3. So the season's going okay. What it really now says is, because we should have realised that Toronto are shit and we were all going to beat them, that really Warrington is 1-3, lost 3. We went to another vote to see how many points everyone thought that Warrington would get in their last 14 games. The vote was between 12 and 14 points. Only 13% went for that. Between 9 and 11 points, 52% went for that. Between 5 and 8, 30%. And between 1 and 4, 5%. We sort of predicted last week that we were going to win around about 9. But now we take Toronto out the equation. So I guess we have to find a win from somewhere else, do we? Or we don't? Can't quite work out how that's going to...
We'll be playing two less games, won't we? In theory.
Yeah.
We've played one of them, but there'll be two less games. So your percentage wins should stay the same, but your number of wins will be fewer.
Okay. All right. Cardboard cutouts, lads. Have you put in your orders? Who's having Dennis obviously will have to go for two, looking at your girth. So it's going to cost you £50, but it's £25 per cutout. Is it, again, a little bit condescending of all the people that have paid for a season ticket and now having to pay an extra £25 to put a cardboard cutout in the stand?
This is the first time I've felt a bit like that with the club, that I appreciate the club are trying to raise a bit of money. Let's be fair. And I asked the two lads I go to the match with, and got two completely different opinions. One of them thought, if I'm not asking for my season ticket money back, I should be given a cardboard cutout free of charge. Whereas the other one said, it's a completely different deal. Buy one or don't, it's up to you. Like buying a replica shirt. So two completely different opinions there.
You don't really need Toronto to buy one, like you say, do you? It's just a choice thing. So if people want to do it, then just do it. You know, no one's making you do it.
Yeah.
Are we going to have a What Bevan one? Are we going to get one together, lads? You've got three interesting characters behind you there, Dennis. Maybe
let's not go there.
We could make the news, but probably for the wrong reasons.
Now, surprise, surprise. We are COVID-free. Super League is boasting 924 tests and no positive outcomes. And they've all been tested twice. I mean, that's good news, isn't it? Not just for rugby league, but for the country. Possibly it is making its way through and we can just get on with that and we don't have to worry about maybe a hurdle falling in place.
I think it's excellent news for a full restart in August. Most likely the interest will come when the temperatures drop in October. But then we'll see whether the country has a hurdle or not. But in terms of getting off to a start next week, great news.
Yes, it's great news. The only trouble is, though, I feel really tentative around this subject because we've been working and we've been through this and everybody was like, you know, getting tested all right. But then all of a sudden when it hits, and I said it last week, I'm more interested in what the plans are going to be to make sure we can keep the game going if we get, you know, somebody positive. I think that's the main thing, isn't it? Because the last thing the game needs now is another disruption. By the way, as we're speaking, the hotspots are moving from Blackburn to Yorkshire towns, places like Wakefield and around Bradford and so on. So watch this space.
Okay.
It comes down to, we've seen the pictures of the lads training this week that the club have put out and some of the lads themselves have put out. And at times, they're all in separate roped-off areas. At times, they're all together. It doesn't seem any consistency there, does it?
No, I don't understand what... I can understand it's almost like they're trying to show they've done as much as they can, but it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it didn't look like they were all social distancing. What I saw when Steve Price had them round in a big circle talking, they weren't in groups of five, were they? That's for sure.
No. I think Josh Chandler was making a cup of tea. Thought, right, that's very good. And then next minute, he's going to be sweating and touching other his colleagues anyway.
I'm a bit worried about the AstroTurf in that indoor arena there. I think he could burn that very easily. I mean, we went camping last year, Dennis. You came round for a barbecue down in Devon and I burnt all the grass with one of those little stoves. So I know he's got it on a little placemat, but I'm just a little bit worried that I'm going to have with a big dirty brown ring if we're not careful. Right, Claire Balding. She's been in the job now, Sam, a week. She seems to have done nothing apart from being on the Today Show. Is it time for Balding to step down and resign?
It must be, because on her watch, we've had a club fold straight away, haven't we?
I mean, Adams was bad enough, but Balding clearly is there's something about her, Dennis. There's a voodoo in Balding. Do you think she'll go by the end of next week, or do you think she'll be pushed?
No, I think she's going to remain. I mean, we know that she's one of your favourites, and you won't hear a bad word say about her. But does she know what's going on?
I think so. Is it the Today Show? I get a bit confused. Is it the Today Show, that one in the evening over there that you sort of watch?
She was on the one show,
and they tried to cut her off, and they gave her about 45 seconds. And she was so articulate in those 45 seconds. She promoted the game more, I reckon, than Tony Adams promoted it in the last 2 years. So
we did say this last week, though, don't we? We did say this last week. Yeah, she is an excellent ambassador.
Did she have that chain on her neck?
If she can get enough, I didn't see it, but if she can get enough chances to speak, she will do well for the game, won't she? Mm.
Do you think now Tony Adams is not part of Rugby League, he might pop into the museum and get himself a part-time job?
Time now for Rimmer's Lot, home of the National Rugby League Museum. And following last week's organising of the Brickhouse Brass Band playing at the Challenge Cup final, let's see what's in store for us this week. Frankly, I try and avoid London the week of the Cup final and go and stay at my sister's in Windsor. What with all those overweight, sweaty northerners making their way down to the capital, attired in polyester.
Good morning. Welcome to the National Rugby League Museum. Ralph Rimmer, CEO, and Museum Curator, Mondays, Wednesdays, and lunchtime Thursdays, at your service. How may I be of assistance? Yes. Yes. No, I'm afraid not, no. Even if you are Canadian or Australian, sir, there is no Commonwealth concessionary reduction available. We use the Elston currency exchange rate only. Yes, the price is a shilling per adult and OAPs go in for a tenner. Although we only let a scrum of six people into the museum at any one time. Otherwise, the smell of ammonia can be a little overwhelming, especially in the Stuart Cummings cloakroom, as there's only one fan in there, and it's a bit shit. And I'm not referring to Phil Clark. Yes, yes, no. Unfortunately, there are no concessionary rates for any disabilities or furlongs. This is a new company policy following on from the Adam Hills turning up and attempting to put on a comedy show. Yes, that's right. We think it was a stand-up show, although nobody stood for long and it didn't really explain all the refunds. excuse me, sir, but may one ask, do I detect an Antipodean accent there? Oh, Mr. Argyle, well, why didn't you say so? Just present yourself at reception, and it's free of charge to come in. Don't worry yourself about the financial details. Yes. It also includes a free six-course visa platter in the canteen. It's a menu inspired by our head chef, Benjamin Westwood. And I would highly recommend his sausage baguettes. All right, then, Ned. Lovely. Tuesday it is. If you could arrive early, though, as we normally expect Steve Broomhead in around 12:30, and he likes to get a start on his all-you-can-eat 50-kilogram buffet. Oh, I don't know how we'll do it, Stevie. Another satisfied customer. Now, have you polished the Claire Balding bust?
Oh, g'day, Ralph. Yeah, no worries. I polished her tits this morning.
Oh, dear Stevie, that's not what I meant. I meant to polish the whole statue. What did you use?
I think it was with a tin of Brasso I found in the cupboard.
Oh, Chacklesacks. That's not the Brasso. That's the Fred Lindrop's Brill Cream. It was going to take pride and place in our incompetent refereeing through the ages gallery.
Oh, shit. Sorry, Ralph. Do you want me to put the president's gold chain on display?
Oh, no, not at the risk of it being stolen. We've got coach parties consecutively booked this week from St. Helens of Widnes, and not forgetting Lee Brays might be popping in.
Well, we could always use the Challenge Cup draw balls if I thread a bit of string through it.
Oh, yes. Oh, Stevie, you're not just a face. That's an excellent idea. But make sure they look like a pearl necklace and not Nigel Wood's anal beads.
Anyway, Ralphie, how are we going to cope with all those guys coming over from Canada next week?
Oh, don't worry yourself, Stevie. The only thing left from that outfit will be a few trinkets for our museum. So run along and go and make some space on the wall in the RFL recycling section.
Well, there you have it. It's all happening on the lot of Rimmer's lot. Sam, you're enjoying it this week? You thought it was a good episode?
I don't think it quite hit the heights of last week.
It must be the script writing, eh?
Area 51.
Did Phil Ford steal Bob Eccles's car? Or is that just a myth? Because I steal fucking cars all the time.
Paul Cullen, save the club. Fake news. Salford lost the last 11 games.
Steve Anderson and the bad coach. Old wives' tale. He was ahead of his time.
Andrew John's a success. Oh, what a storytelling. He lost to Hull 40 points to 6.
Bob Mays, the ghost of Orwell the Spilled Town. It's just a fable.
In 2019, Steve Price only had a 20% winning margin over the second half of the season, and that's no joke. Not that I know much about rugby league, although I did go and watch Fulham once.
Okay, we tried to convert everyone to the factual truth rather than the bigoted plot behind Wyatt's Andrew Johns, and we've taken a look at Union converts converted to Warrington players. So to keep on converting, today our goal kickers take conversions over the Area 51 perimeter fence. But before we start, lads,
Oh, hello.
I have to apologise for a factually incorrect quote during last week's Area 51. Ooh. Now, Sam, you may remember you and I were chatting away. We were having a really good chat about rugby union players and players that had come in. And it was all going very well, wasn't it? Do you remember it was all sort of kicking along nicely? And you'd read the script and you'd seen all the players. Yep. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, someone said this.
Just to add to that, I don't know if you mentioned them because I was reading it, but there was Owen Bevan.
Owen Bevan. All of a sudden, Dennis comes out, just reading a piece of paper. He's seen the word Owen and he's seen the word Bevan and he thinks he's a rugby union convert. Was that where you were coming from, Dennis, at the time?
You know what it is? Because I switched off, I thought, maybe I should say something. I'll just look at this. And I've not heard this said, but I'll just throw it in there. Was Owen Bevan a really high-profile rugby union player?
I woke up to a series of missed FaceTime calls from a very anxious 93-year-old Mr. London, who was trying to contact me, because he gets the podcast a little bit early. I send it to him, God love him, on an email before it goes out, to say, please don't put the podcast out. Dennis doesn't know what he's talking about. Sam, do you want to have a punt, mate? Sam, do you want to have a punt who Owen Bevan is?
Was he a politician in Wales?
Owen Bevan was not Welsh. He was Brian Bevan's younger brother.
Oh.
And we signed him on the premise that we thought he was going to be as fast as Brian Bevan.
Okay.
Well, he turned out not to be that quick. But as my dad pointed out, one thing that Brian Bevan could never do was tackle. But one thing that Owen Bevan was very good at was tackling. Now, Warrington have him down as a centre, but my dad swears he played more games at loose forward for Warrington. And I did a bit of digging this week, and it does turn out that Owen Bevan played a fair bit of rugby league in Sydney as a loose forward. So, no, he was a belting tackler, and he was Brian Bevan's brother. So do you want to apologise to Mr. London, Dennis, before we move on?
No.
No. It's nice, isn't it? Okay, right, let's move on to conversions then. Now, this is only a theory, lads. I've done quite a bit of work on this week at looking at different reasonings why possibly we need to look at the converters in the Warrington Kickers and come up with a new equation on who has kicked the most goals. We've had nearly 12,000 conversions between the sticks. We've had 201 players kick at goal for Warrington. That's everyone that's actually attempted and kicked a goal. There have been a fair few that also have kicked at goal and missed, but we've had 201 that have kicked goals. We've got 28 players that have kicked over 100 conversions, and we'll come on to the list in a little bit. One thing we couldn't do on this is we've addressed this in the terms of how many goals they would have all have kicked if they were all kicking from an even keel, if they were all kicking the same year on the same ground with the same ball, who would convert the most kicks. We've not done it on a calculation of some of the players like John Woods, who was a sublime kicker, but unfortunately didn't kick enough goals. He wasn't with the club long enough for his calculations to rise him to the top of the pile. So apologies for that. It's only a theory, but we're basing it on the attempts that all these players took, how many they would have actually kicked over the sticks if everything had been the same. A few things we needed to look at. The changing of the ball through the decades, which has impacted the kinetic energy and also the Magnus effect on how the ball travels. Anyone know anything about kinetic energy and the Magnus effect?
I do, but I'm going to let you run with it because obviously I have a section coming on tackle
yes,
back.
Dennis,
so
true.
We know that we're going to cross here, so but you go ahead and explain.
All right, okay. So there's four factors that makes a ball fly through the air. It's thrust, lift, gravity and drag. They're the four implements that you need to look at. The Magnus effect is the force exerted on a rapidly spinning cylinder or sphere moving through air or another fluid in the direction of an angle to the axis of its spin. This is the responsible for swerving the ball when it's hit or it's thrown. Okay,
so it's nothing to do with you with your hands down your pants, is it?
No, it's not. It's Magnus effect has more really to do with a golf ball and the pimples on a golf ball. But nevertheless, there are pimples on a rugby league ball, so it does have a slight effect. The main one we need to look at is kinetic energy. Now, there's five types of kinetic energies. Anyone know anything about kinetic energy and what they were? Remember physics, Sam, and the kinetic energies? So we've got radiant kinetic energy, which is basically just heat.
Oh, yes.
We've got thermal kinetic energy, which is very similar to the radiant energy, but it refers more to the atoms and molecules in an object. We've got sound kinetic energy, which is the vibrations through the air.
Can you just change your voice to Brian Cox as you do this bit?
Oh, some have electrical caused by the flow and negativity charged electrons around the circuit.
Carry on as your normal voice.
Almost, yeah. Give it a few weeks. But the one we need to look at is mechanical kinetic energy, and that's literally the energy associated with the mechanical movement of an object. So the most important feature on a rugby ball when kicking is how much kinetic energy it can store and how quickly it can release it. So the bigger the dent, the greater the energy transferred to the ball from the player's kick. But the quicker the ball returns to its original shape, the quicker that energy is released, allowing the ball to travel further and faster. This ability is dependent on what materials it's made out of, what the bladder's made out of, what the outer layers are made out of.
You could do with a bladder made out of that.
So it's using the energy to make it go forward rather than just absorbing it and dissipating it and falling flat.
All these things. So you've got to base that as well. You've also got to look at the size of the ball. Now, a classic example of this, because rugby league and rugby union doesn't really have too many examples or stats on rugby balls going back through time and how they've changed. But the main one, if you look at it, is a golf ball. So UK golf ball, British golf ball, up until the 1990s, was 1.62 inches in diameter in comparison to the US golf ball, which is 1.68 inches in diameter. All the four major golf tournaments from 1974, you had to use a 1.68 golf ball. But I can remember going around Lynn with a 1.62 golf ball when I was about 17 and 18 and having a real crack at trying to hit the par fives in two. And then the minute that new ball came along, you were 30 yards back. They reckon on average the 1.62 golf ball traveled an extra 15% in comparison to the 1.68. that you see on the tour. How far do you think an average tour player on the PGA golf tour hit a golf ball in 1980, a drive?
290 yards.
Not quite that far. 275.
You're both a little bit over. 256 yards and 0.89. 256 yards. How far do you think they hit it in 2019?
Close to 300.
Yeah.
312.
295. They predict that the average drive off a golf tee in the PGA Tour will be over 300 yards within the next 5 years. But also the accuracy has increased by 22% in just that short period of time.
So are we about to come onto a table to look at how good Libre is his driving when he plays golf? Or are we talking about kicking conversions?
Well, we're going to put it all together in a set. But we should also say in 1900, the average drive of a golf ball was 150 yards. And by 1930, it had gone up to 190 yards. Okay. Not always is it a case that things get better. In AFL, they were kicking a ball a lot further before the war than they were after the war. And that's because the ball was actually slightly bigger, but had a bigger kinetic energy spot to hit from. So it's become more accurate, but they're not kicking it as far as they did in the olden days. But it wasn't as accurate. From a standard spot in AFL in the 1930s, 40% of kicks went over. In comparison to this day, 85% of kicks go over because the ball is so much easier to kick. Okay. Right.
Or are they partly full-time professionals as well, so they're practicing more?
This is it, Sam. I mean, we've got to put all this into the equation as well. Okay. One of the other reasons being is that also if you look at Warrington players, you look at that magnificent team of the, I think it's about 1910, where Warrington's got this infamous pack that's feared throughout the land as it travels on the train across the Pennines. Not one of the prop forwards weighed 12 stone. We've looked at all the different players and how many kicks they've converted. So basing all that into the facts and looking at why possibly balls didn't go as far in the olden days, it's become quite clear that between about 1900 and about 1920, no one could kick the ball from the touchline over the bar. It just couldn't be done. The ball was too heavy. It weighed about the same. It didn't weigh any more than it weighs now, but it was made of leather and it had big seams. And the minute it got wet, it was like kicking a, you know, a temping bowl.
And for anyone with anyone out there with a father like mine, talking more mostly about football rather than rugby, he used to say, "Let's see how far they kick it when or head it when it's coming to you, and you see those laces in front of it, and you put your head down because you don't want to get hurt."
Yeah, exactly.
Said in that accent.
Exactly. So another reason why they all toe poked. They all toe poked back then because there was no reasoning not to toe poke. This kind of carried on and the ball got slightly better, but it was still a leather ball up until the 1980s. The difference being that they didn't have a spray on the ball, so it was sprayed to try and keep it waterproof, but it didn't help the ball too much. Yes, it was a lot better, but it was no comparison to the balls that we have today. We then went to a sort of leather synthetic ball in the 1990s, before in the mid-90s we went to a full synthetic ball, and that's the balls that we use now. They have such a strong amount of kinetic energy in comparison to a ball from the 80s or the 70s. It just doesn't bear significance in comparison to how many kicks you can kick with a ball now. We've also got a look at when sand was introduced. Up until probably 1990, most players are actually just putting their heel into the ground and making a mould. My dad told me a story this week of my Uncle Norman, who was a very good rugby union player for Warrington Rugby Union, trying to use sand, or actually trying to use a bit of mud, and the referee coming over and telling him he couldn't do that. So I'm not sure where the rules lay. I've even watched a fair bit of rugby league this week in Australia from the 1960s, and they're still not using sand. They're still putting it in the floor by just using the base of their heel. So the game really improved when sand came along. Fran Obotica was kicking off sand. He wasn't kicking off a tee. I would have thought Fran Obotica was off a tee, but he wasn't. He was off sand. And then we move on to the likes of Lee Breers, who's kicking off a tee, etc. Again, the difference between sand and tee, and this is an analysis done in rugby union, not in rugby league, there was a 12% increase in performance the minute they went to a kicking tee.
Because it's consistency, isn't it? You're kicking off the identical height and surface all the time rather than having to make it with your own bit of sand.
Exactly. If you're putting it in the same place every time, Sam, you're going to get the same reaction if you're hitting it the same way. We've got 28 players who've kicked more than 100 goals. Okay, I'll read them in reverse order. Kurt Gidley, Chris Rudd, David Lyon, Brian Carbert, Chris Hicks, Eddie Cattrall, Rocky Turner, Stephen Ratchford, Billy Belshaw, Yistin Harris, Paul Bishop, George Thomas, Keith Affleck, Chris Bridge, Jonathan Davis, John Woods, Jack Fisher, Brej Hodgson, and then we're moving to the top 10, Ben Jolly, Jeff Bootle, Laurie Gilfeder, Harold Palin, Eric Fraser, Derek Whitehead, Harry Bath, Billy Holding, Lee Breers, and the top one is Steve Hesford. Well, Steve Hesford's kicked the most amount of goals. He's kicked 1,112 goals. He kicked them in 318 games. Breers, in 425 games, kicked 948. Hesford, on average, is kicking 3.49 goals per game. Breers is only kicking 2.23. One thing we haven't got, though, or I know you've got a bit more on this, Sam, is we haven't got actually their percentages. There's no percentages through time how many goals they're missing in comparison to their scoring. That's come on more now onto the modern day, hasn't it? You've got a little bit on that.
Even the Super League website doesn't provide you with percentages, but it does provide you with the number of goals missed. So obviously by doing the calculation between goals scored and missed, you can come on to percentages. Our most consistent kicker over the last five seasons has been Steph Ratchford. This year kicking at 77%. Last year at 80%, the year before at 75%, and the year before that 71%. But interestingly, who do you think has got the best percentage over the last 5 years for goal kicking?
Oh, someone who hasn't kicked that many, I would think.
Well, he's kicked a few. In 2019, Deck Patton kicked at 90%.
How many goals did he have?
37 kicks and 37 conversions and 4 misses.
It's pretty good, isn't it?
Is it not a factor, though, that where they actually score the tries? as well.
It is, but and that makes a difference, I suppose, if you've only kicked 10 goals and all 10 are from in front of the posts. Mm. But when you get to the games that Steve Hedgeford and Lee Braes have been playing, 300 games, and then you're going to be taking conversions from all over the place, aren't you?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll look at the kickers used from each position between 1895 and 2020. And it's quite an evenly split array of positions, really, on the field where the kicks have come from. 19% of all the goal kickers have been centres. We've got 18% as fullbacks. We've got 14% as wingers. Scrum halves, I thought, was a little bit low, and that's 13%. And then it drops off to 12% standoffs. Utility forwards, it was hard to say whether they were a prop or a second row or a loose forward. They were at 9%. 7% second row, 3% at prop, only 2% at hooker, which I thought was low. Sam, did that surprise you when you saw that?
It did initially, but I then thought that might be because in the modern game, obviously, we've got Smith down there at Melbourne taking the kicks, so you tend to think it's not unusual for a hooker to kick for goal, and he's obviously one of the best kickers over the last 10 years or so. But I thought, maybe it's just that's skewing my thinking.
Yeah.
Of course, in the old days, a hooker was doing far more, I wouldn't say work in one sense, but in that scrum, getting kicked, getting smashed, whereas in the modern day, they're not raking the ball, are they? So you'd expect them to be fresher and more able to kick a goal.
Well, we've only had 5 hookers that have kicked at goal for Warrington in all that time. Mm. John Clark has kicked more goals, if you class him as a hooker. I mean, you could say he was a loose forward, couldn't you?
No, he's a hooker.
Okay. Well, he's kicked 2 goals, and he leads the chart on 2 goals, followed by Mickey Higham on 1, Charlie Middlehurst on 1, Mickey Sullivan, Michael Sullivan, who I think we kind of signed as a scrum half, but I think he ended up playing at hooker a bit, didn't he? Mm-hmm. He's also kicked 1. And Kevin Ashcroft hasn't actually kicked a conversion, but he did kick a drop goal. And they're the only 5 that we've had. Looking at where most of the goals have come from by position, well, there's a clear winner. 47% of all goals that Warrington have ever kicked have come from their fullback. 16% has come from their centres, 11% come from their utility forwards, and then it really does drop off. So it seems that the composure seems to be around fullbacks, or the fact that Steve Hesford and a couple of other guys who kicked a lot of goals have all kicked them from the fullback position. They've kicked they've kicked just over 5,000 goals between them. The next best one is the centres, who have kicked 1,745 goals, and then you've got the standoffs down there at 1,182.
Yeah, and that surprised me slightly, that I would have expected the scrum half and standoff to be the top two, really, because over the history of the game, they're the playmakers, they're the ones you expect to be more skillful, they're the ones that do most of the in-game kicking. So it did surprise me slightly.
Okay, right, so we'll come on to the technology adjustment factor then. So this is based on the way that they look at golfers and how far golfers hit the ball, and also how they look at AFL players. And we've just basically calculated into the same method as what we've done with the Warrington players and how many games they've played in comparison to how many goals they've scored. So the way that the chart works is really through each decade, you look at factors in the game that decide why they should be kicking more goals. So between 2001 and 2010, you don't get anything added on to any of the goals that you've kicked, because they're pretty much using the same ball and the same boots as they've been using now in 2020. But anyone who's kicked goals between 1991 and 2000, you add 12% onto their goal tally. Between 81 and 1990, you add on 30%. And the list goes on. Between 71 and 80, you add on 45%. 61 to 70, 60%. 51 to 1960, 75%. 1941 to 1950, 100%. So you're kicking double the amount of goals than you would be kicking. And this is where you start coming in now with the ones that are on the touchline. 1931 to 1940, 120%. 21 to 1930, 125%. 1911 to 1920, 135%. And it goes on. 1901 to 1910, 140%. And 1885 to 1900, an extra 150%. So an extra 3 goals that you're missing, you're now kicking. Intriguing to see that on this list, Everyone had a pop at the goal in 1895. We didn't have a goal kicker by the looks of it. Between, I'm not sure. Do we know if you scored a try, you had to kick the goal?
Was the wording of a try comes from originally. Now, I don't know whether, because I don't know whether this was in rugby league, but in rugby per se, if you scored a try, you were awarded a try for goal. So you were only scoring if you kicked the ball through the posts. So you had to get the ball over the line, which entitled you to try for goal.
Right. Okay. So that's where that's fallen into play then, by the sounds of things. That's where it's coming in from. Because if you look at these 201 kickers, a lot of them are weighted more towards before 1930. And then all of a sudden we seem to get a more prominent goalkeeper through each decade as we go through with the team. We seem to settle on a goal kicker.
Yeah, and I suppose you suddenly start thinking, if you've got a specialist, then you're scoring more points. Because if you score 100 tries and you only convert 50 of them, you're only scoring 100 points. But if you convert at 90%, that's 180 points. It's 80 points more, isn't it, through the game. That can win and lose your matches.
Yeah, makes a big difference. A big difference indeed. Okay, right. So we'll come on to the technology adjustment factor and see how many of the Warrington players would have kicked 100 goals. So before we had 28. Well, it actually jumps up now to 34 players. It doesn't go up too much, but we go up to 34 players. Kirk Gidley finds himself still at the bottom of the rung on the 100 club. He's now down to 34th. But we'll just go in now. I think we'll reel off the top 20. And I'll reel off the top 10 with their points. So in the top 20, it goes at 20, Jack Preston. He was a forward in 1904. At 19, can't forget him, Paul Bishop in 1984. Jonathan Davis comes in at 18th. Eddie Catterall comes in at 17th. Brett Hodgson comes in at 16th. The thing with Brett Hodgson, Sam, is he just didn't kick enough goals. He wasn't at the club long enough. You could say he was possibly one of our top goal kickers of all time, but the way these calculations work, he's just not kicking words.
Exactly.
Keith Affleck, he comes in 15th place. And then, as we mentioned before, John Woods, who I thought was a beautiful goal kicker. They very rarely went more than a metre over the bar, and he seemed to side foot them over. He comes in at 14th, but he just doesn't play enough games to get him up that ladder. Billy Belshaw comes in at 13th, George Thomas at 12th, and Jeff Bootle at 11th. So we'll move now into the top 10. At 10, Jack Fish played in 1898. He now has a conversion rate of 642 on the adjustment factor based on everything that we've discussed. At 9, Ben Jolly, he's a fullback in 1912. He's kicked 744 goals. And then at 8, we've got Laurie Gilfeder. He's kicked 745 goals in 1951. These are all the debut years they started playing at the Wire. At number 7, Eric Fraser, he's also 1951. He now hits 827 goals. And then in 6th, we have Harold Palin, 1936 loose forward. He hits 959 goals. And then Lee Breers. Lee Breers drops down a little bit. In 1997, he made his debut. He's now kicked 1,061 goals. He picks up an extra 113 goals based on the fact the ball he was kicking with early on. And then at 4th, we've got Derek Whitehead, 1969 fullback. He's on 1,140. And then Steve Hesford, who would have been my pick of all the players that I've ever seen kick a footy, I'd have gone for Steve Hesford. He drops down to 3rd with 1,612 goals. In 2nd place, just beating him, is Harry Bath, who was kicking it toe-ended, 1,624 goals. But the clear winner is a gentleman from 1928. He played 328 games for Warrington. He kicked 830 goals, but on the technology adjustment factor, he's now kicked 1,867, and that's Billy Holding. Now, I didn't know much about Billy Holding. So again, I went to my historian, my dad, and he straight away said, "Oh, Billy Holding, don't talk to me about Billy Holding. Your granddad went on about Billy Holding being the best goal kicker Warrington's ever had. And he watched goal kickers up until the 1970s. So we can get up to Steve Hesford with one generation before I sort of come into play. And he said there was no one in comparison to kick goals like Billy Holding. So I'm saying, and it's just a theory, based on if we were all kicking a modern day football, Billy Holding would have been the greatest kicker Warrington Rugby League clubs ever had. Okay, now last time out, Daniel focused on the Super League player he'd most like the Wolves to sign. But with the season only a couple of weeks away, rather than looking at the potential signing, here's Daniel to give his opinion on how he'd like the Mighty Wire to line up on August the 8th.
With a high volume of games in a quite short space of time, that's not something that rugby league clubs are used to. So I think, like we've seen with the football since that restarted, the Super League clubs, they're going to have to do a lot of shuffling the pack, bit of rotation to get through it and make sure that they've got the squad depth to cope with a larger number of fixtures. I've gone with Stephen Ratchford at fullback. I think he'd been arguably Warrington's best player so far this season. I know a few of those games have been actually in the halves, but I still think his best position is fullback for now, so I've kept him there. Tom Lynham and Josh Charnley on the two wings, no real surprises there. There aren't too many other options apart from maybe Jake Mamo or Matty Ashton, but in the centres I've got Toby King. He'd been having quite a good season, the last few games in particular before we shut down he was playing really well. And next to King, I would like to see Matty Ashton tried out at centre. I think his searing pace is something we're missing from that centre position right now. And I can understand why people might want him at fullback, but for me, Ratchford has the edge on him defensively, certainly. And I think we need Ratchford to have as much of the ball as possible because he's one of our more influential players. So I think let's give Ashton a run in the centre. I certainly want to see him in the side now that he's back from injury, because his pace is unbelievable. He's a very exciting player, and I think he adds a different dimension to something that we've already got. And then the rest of it pretty much picks itself, certainly in the halves do. Austin and Widdop, no surprises at all there. I've gone with Mike Cooper, Daryl Clark, but I've actually gone with Joe Philbin as the other prop. I think that the end of this season should be used to prepare for the future as well as prepare for, you know, the rest of this season. And I wonder if it's time to start thinking about the next generation of props that are going to play instead of Hill and Cooper in a few years' time. So starting Philbin, I think, would be part of that. So I've gone with Philbin, Clark and Cooper for my pack. Ben Curry and Ben Murdoch-Marcella in the second row, no changes there. Even though Jack Hughes is back from injury, I would like to see Jack Hughes deployed as a loose forward. I think he's got the handling skills to do it. We saw that in the Challenge Cup final last year when he played at standoff, number six, and did a really good job. So I certainly think he's got the handling skills, he's got the work rate, and he gets through plenty of effort and industry through the match. So let's give Jack Hughes a go, which means that my interchange bench is Chris Hill, Jason Clark, Matt Davis, and then currently Danny Walker. So going through those one by one, I mentioned about Hill, and could we start to phase him out slowly? I still think he's an important part of the team in many respects, but I don't think he should be starting. Jason Clark, he's been starting a lot this season, but I think now that Jack Hughes is back, and with Ben Curry and Ben Murdoch-Marcella, who've both been in good form this season, I don't think you can really drop either of those two. But Jack Hughes is an important player as well, so I want to see all three of those start, which will mean the bench players for Jason Clark. Matt Davis, we've not seen too much of this season, but I think Davis is a good little player. He's industrious, he's hard-working, and I think he's a useful player to have off the bench. He can also cover dummy half areas as well. And then Danny Walker, who has actually been starting quite a few games until the shutdown, but that was down to lack of fitness of Daryl Clark. So I'm assuming that Daryl Clark will be back to full fitness and he will start at hooker, which would mean a bench spot for Danny Walker. So I'll be happy with that. So some people I didn't include, Jake Mamo, who could probably feel a little bit hard done by not to be on the bench, because last season he was spending quite a bit of time on the bench, coming on as an impact sub in the backs. Akawala, yeah, again, we need a bit more firepower on the bench, and I think the bench that I've picked could do longer stints and have a bigger influence on the game. But what I've picked there is a side that I think is a very, very strong side, has quality in every area, but also a strong bench and some players that didn't quite make my team there. And I think strengthening depth is going to be so important as we restart with a lot of games in a short period of time.
Well, Dennis, has Daniel picked a winning team there that takes it all?
He's picked the team that most people would pick if you look at the 17, maybe a couple of exceptions, which he points out. His bits for analysis are Ashton at centre, which is always going to create a debate, and you've got Philbin ahead of Hill, which is also a bit of a debate, but probably some that mostly would agree with that. He's left a couple out, Mamo and Akawala, but his main point was the rotation, and we've talked about rotation before, in terms of, you know, we don't really tend to do a lot of it, or Price hasn't anyway. If more than ever, with the condensed sort of like end to the season and so on, and the new rules, rotation is probably going to be one of the most important things. So those fringe players are really going to come into it. You mentioned it about like doing the depth of the squad. So Mamo, Akwala, and maybe some of the fringe players as well are going to be, you know, quite important for this season.
Mm. But that starting lineup, that's what you'd go for as well?
Yeah, I don't think there's any exceptions there. I think that's it. I think the other thing to consider is when, you know, we're always banging on about forwards. Well, actually, maybe not so much. You want more mobile people. So his interchange bench of Hill, Clark, Davis and Walker do give you that. So, you know, you might argue, should we have Akwala on there as another prop? That's probably the only thing. But in general, that's the team.
And you're happy with Ashton at centre and Ratchford at fullback?
Ashton, I think we've discussed before. I think he might be a bit too slight for centre at the moment. I'd still put him at fullback. I'd probably have Ratchford in the centres.
Just switching
where
around.
I'd do it. Yeah,
Sam, what did you think, mate?
I think Dennis has covered the majority of the points. I wouldn't have Ashton at centre, but I wouldn't have Hill on the bench. I'd be starting Chris Hill. But similar to Dennis, I think the bench and the fringe players could make or break our first three or four games. I've written down these people as I see Philbin as guaranteed on the bench. So I'm going as a pack, this is I'm talking, going Cooper, Clark, Hill, the two Bens at second row and Hughes at loose. And I'm saying that Philbin and Jason Clark for me are two guarantees on the bench. But then those other two spots, rotating over those first three games, Danny Walker, Sitter, Luther, potentially, Matt Davis and Lewis Johnson. I'm seeing them as the key to keeping us all fresh and potentially being fitter than other teams as we go into the last 20 minutes. When it comes to the backs, we've got Ashton and Mamo to potentially rotate with what I would see as a starting lineup. But I expect Steve Price to go King and Gelling at centre, because everything we've seen from him beforehand suggests that he would prefer strength at centre over pace.
So who are you starting with at fullback? Are you going Ratchford or...?
Ratchford, yeah. I agree with Daniel. Ratchford has to be in the team somewhere. Personally, I've said before, I see our best 13 on the pitch, albeit we've only seen Matt Ashton for three or four games, wasn't it, before he got injured. I think on the pitch, I'd like him at fullback and I'd like Ratchford at centre. And I'd like Widdop and Austin in the halves. I think that's our most exciting option for scoring tries. But whether it happens is another matter.
I reckon that we're going to have this dilemma between Ashton and Ratchford. It's going to continue, which is a great dilemma to have. It's a great problem, isn't it, to have two players that are fighting for that one spot. Or we rotate them and one plays in the centre one week and one plays in the centre the other week. But I'm saying that we play Ashton at fullback. And we move Ratchford, not into the centre, but we move Ratchford to six and we move Blake Austin to 13. I think he's big enough to play there. I think he's a big lad. You know, you look at all the great standoffs through the years in Australia. They've all played 13 as well. We keep going on about we haven't got a ball playing 13. I know his tackling might not be good enough. What do you think about that, Sam?
I think that I would not start Blake Austin at 13. However, in the Tony Smith era, we saw two hookers on the pitch. When Michael Monaghan would go off, Hyam would come on, then Monaghan would come back on and play at 13. Before that, John Clark would occasionally play at 13. So I think you might have something in this that later on in the game, to have them all on the pitch at the same time, you might see him playing in the middle.
I mean, we'd have bags of pace out there, wouldn't we? If we had Austin at 13, that explosive pace moving around.
For some reason, I think Ratchford might have played 13.
I think he has. Or
it might be that we got an injury within the game and he moved to 13.
Yeah, I think so.
Talk about injuries. When I was looking at the, we mentioned it last week about the NRL and the amount of injuries. Unfortunately, as it will be, is that chances are after about 8-9 games, we may have picked up one or two first team player injuries. So depending where that hits, it gives you, obviously, you know, you can change things around. But it's interesting that, you know, we all ignored Burrell and Gelling in that, unless anybody...
Well, I didn't.
No, you mentioned Burrell because you...
To be fair, neither did Daniel. We just cut it down a little bit. He did give a few caveats towards the end. He didn't think he'd seen enough of Burrell really to stick him in. And he didn't really know where Gelling was coming from, where we were at with Gelling in terms of, I guess, he didn't say why, but a few reasons being. So one thing he did do was he moved Chris Hill down to the bench. Hmm. At some point, he has to go to the bench, I presume. Is it next year that he starts swapping with Philbin? At some point, he's going to get a little bit long in the tooth, isn't he?
Yes, but the one thing we have just had in locked is... It's effectively an enforced off-season.
Yeah.
And so for someone like Hill, well, there's a few of them who have played 2 or 3 or 4 years continuously because they go and play with England or Great Britain and then come back from there at the end of November and then they're back in training 3 weeks later. He has just had at least 3 months off, hasn't he?
He has, but in those 3 months, Sam, he's got older.
No, I agree with that. But I'm on about for this year.
Yeah.
For this year, you might see a refreshed and rejuvenated Chris Hill.
Well, the question is then, at some point he starts playing less, he spends less time on the park.
Yes.
Does then it just not become viable for him to be captain? Do we get to that stage where he's not on the park long enough to be captain and we need to start looking at a new captain next year?
It wouldn't surprise me to see the idea of co-captains like we had a couple of years ago. But you'd expect from what we've seen of him as a player in Australia, it'd be surprising if Gareth Widdop isn't the man on the pitch organising everyone, wouldn't you?
I was looking at this and addressing how Hill addresses referees, and he reminds me a little bit of my 5-year-old. The way he comes at referees.
Aggressively.
Yeah, it's always like he's got this look on his face as if to say, you know, what have we done wrong? And he's in the face of them. And you watch Widdop at St. George and he comes over very sort of, you know, articulately asks a question. He nods to the referee and then he gives his suggestion as to why possibly the referee's got it wrong or what he needs to look at. It's a very different conversation in the one that Chris Hill has with referees.
I think maybe if we can find somewhere on YouTube the famous one where Lee Breers goes up to the referee in the Challenge Cup match and says, "Sir, why was that, sir? What was that for, sir?" And it's picked up perfectly on the mic, whereas obviously trying to get on the best side of him.
Yeah, best way to be.
Well, okay. The other one where they just started using mics and he goes up and he says something like, he swears and the referee says, "Lee, I'm on the mic." "Oh, shit, I forgot."
Oh, dear. Deary me. Okay, the Twitter vote. We've pretty much spoken about this already. The question was, which team would we like to see replace Toronto Wolfpack for the remainder of the 2020 Super League season? It's not going to happen, but we gave 4 options, which was Toulouse, Bradford Bulls, London, or just stick to the 11 teams. The winner was just stick to the 11 teams on 39%. The next one was London on 26% and Bradford and Toulouse 18% and 17% each. It does, though, throw a little bit of a query up here, as you've mentioned before, Sam, and that is if Toronto don't come back in, who the hell are we picking to come up? What's it going to be? I mean, is it going to be tendered? How are we going to do it?
It wouldn't surprise me. If Toronto are not allowed... Let's assume... Argyle says, "I'm going to guarantee the money for 2021. I don't think it's straightforward that the other 11 teams will let them in. So if they don't, it wouldn't surprise me that next year we stay with 11 teams. Ooh. and have no relegation in the idea that those 11 teams will want some certainty for money and prospects next year.
So you don't think, I mean, Dennis, do you think the Cumbrian Otters will be up and running by next year? I mean, you sort of on the in there.
Yeah, it'd be nice to think so. But I think, I agree with Sam. I think it'll just stick with 11 teams. I don't think Toronto will be in there. I think they should be taken out anyway. And it'd be just maybe you can choose a bye week or something like that.
Ooh. Go and do some community service or something that week.
Yeah.
Could use them for something that week.
Yeah. It will end up with an extra loop fixture because the clubs won't allow themselves to lose an extra
play Wigan five times again.
Yeah, rather than just four. Yeah.
Now, good news, everyone, as there's a rumour after 70 episodes that this section has finally run dry following his outlandish suggestion that the RFL build a Superdome on Saddleworth Moor. So with a publishing contract signed for his top 50 tackle bag ideas Christmas annual stocking filler, at last, open the champagne, everyone. Yes, for one more excruciating 10-minute spell only, it's time for...
Tackle Bags.
You're joking. Not another one? Oh, for God's sake, I can't stand this.
Is it only 10 minutes?
Well, we'll try and make it a bit shorter if you want. It's not going to happen. Last week, then, to try and address some of the issues around the visas for Toronto players and enable them to finish the season, I came up with a rugby league village with a rugby league superdome. The complex known as Super League's local utility township would be an area that all the amenities would be there necessary to accommodate teams from around the world. This would be a designated free zone by the government, getting around the issue of visas by setting up an independent consulate led by an ambassador abiding by the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. Perfect. So the teams could play there, come and go as they like, and then basically the Super League could be finished. Well, didn't quite work, did it? A bit too late with this one. Should have brought it out last year, I think. So anyway, fans didn't agree. They were responding with a protest vote against Toronto as well. 64% said no. Woolly Muff Bucket, he said, what's the point of a massive dome? There would be no away fans and it would need a small nuclear reactor to heat the fucker up. So,
ooh.
It's probably not the best.
Need some kinetic energy.
Yeah, that's right. One of the five forms of kinetic energy. If this podcast is nothing else, it's a learning of tool.
I don't remember Miss Shorrocks telling me about five different forms of kinetic energy physics.
You know what we need? We need some kind of physicist on the show, don't we? That's what we need to do. Look into that.
Yeah, like a Brian Cox, but we're going to have to think of someone else after what we heard before. 35% said yes. I think this is off a Toronto fan called Madison. Love it. The Blue Jays play in a dome. It's visually stunning and has a nail bar salon and Instagram magic picture mirror in the lounge. Me and my girlfriends love to drink cocktails and fool around while the game's on. Not really the point of the Super Bowl.
The place I was meant to be going to in Toronto was overlooking the Blue Jays dome.
I
could have met Madison then. Yeah. Never mind. Oh,
dear.
Filled around with some cocktails.
There was only one other thing this week. It's off Jimmy's Gimp Mask, and he just said, dome wasn't built in a day.
Very good.
So, yes, as Rob has said, the last tackle bags barrel, this is the last one. However, there's been a reprieve because I've now got a fan, Gareth Monkey, who's now on board. He's going to be part of, we have a sponsored section for tackle bags, and he's now been challenged to write 15 more for the rest of the season. Anyway, this week, the theme has been kicking and a subject that's captured the imagination of the podcast. Rob has already alluded to the changes in technology when it comes to the ball. So following on from this analysis, I'm also, again, looking at ball technology. Now, we've already covered this a couple of times on tackle bags. Do you remember what they were?
You had the chip in the ball to know whether we've been scored or not.
Excellent. Thank you, Sam. Any others?
Nah. I was listening in the early days. I was listening.
The illuminated ball in the UV game.
Oh, yes. Interesting you should say that, Dennis, because when I did my research, the ball that travelled the furthest in the Rugby Union World Cup was a 1990 ball that was fluorescent.
Now, isn't that interesting? Because I want to introduce a new patented rugby league ball. It's the competition ovoid competitive kicking ball. Here, the surface panels are changed to enable the flight of the ball to travel much at a greater distance with stability and accuracy. And I'll cover off some of these physics that Rob's already alluded to, just to reinforce the sort of belief about how things move. The ball itself is constructed with molded indentations in the structure of the panels that run the length of the ball, where the molded geometric grooves reduce the drag. So much like a golf ball, it functions by creating a thin, turbulent boundary of layer of air that clings to the ball's surface, allowing the ball to move smoothly through the air with less friction. So that's less the general
drag.
Principle.
Less drag. The Magnus effect. Drag. The Magnus effect.
There you go. So with the introduction of this technology, it's envisaged that the ball will increase its efficiency of around 20%, which I think Rob's already alluded to. Now, the goal kicking in terms of this will allow a team to take a shot from goal from their own half. So the stability of the ball
exciting.
In flight.
Where's my season ticket? I'll sign now.
Yes, the stability in the ball flight would essentially make a shot from 60 metres all about accuracy, less than about the conditions of the ball in flight. So this opens up the rugby league game to a new dynamic where penalties conceded in the defending half could easily be punished by a two-point conversion.
It'd be like watching rugby union from the 90s.
Oh, no. This is a whole new dynamic. Imagine taking a penalty kick from your own 20.
Kick.
Two points. Maybe you could then increase the by 10 metres. Actually, you score 3 points. I'm making this up now. And then if you score from your own 20 line, you get 5 points. So
why
anyway,
don't you make a drop goal? Why don't you make a drop goal 3 points as well while you're at it?
Well, anyway, this ball technology all exists at the moment, and this is no way a copy of Nike's new AeroSculpt technology in the ball that's going to be used for 2020 and 2021. However, this is my rugby league version of much the same thing. My lab has been up and running for months on this and years, extensively testing, and this is what I've come up with. So I'll be negotiating with Nike in the next few weeks, and I'll be then having a conversation with our friend Ralph Rimmer about introducing it for 2021.
Oh, very good.
Some competition for Steeden.
Steeden? Who's he? The Avengers.
Oh, for fuck's sake. You're making a new ball. You don't even know who your main competitor is. How many dimples do you think are on a golf ball, Sam?
365.
Oh, that's very good. I tell you what, I'm going to give him that. I'm going to give him a point for that. Between 300 and 400 dimples. On a golf ball. If you want the ball to spin, you make the dimples deeper. And if you want it to actually fly further in the air, you make the dimples a little bit shallower. And
did Sam understand that question? Because he just said 365 days happens to be the number of days in a year. Sort of.
I know it does, but I remember the one particular ball was marketed as the golf ball for every day of the year.
Oh.
I think it was a Titleist one. But again,
what happens when you're trying to dredge it out of Walton Golf Course with your shopping trolley?
Exactly.
I've shot shit.
Remain indoors. Remain indoors.
You are now listening to the Rugby League Emergency Broadcast System.
Welcome back to the Warrington Wolves Isolation News, reporting every week on what the players of the Warrington Wolves have been getting up to. Our supercomputer, Lottie, will analyse the web and social media activities each week and randomly select a player and isolation activity for the podcast to analyse. So, without further ado, Lottie, let's plot those dots from those wire clots. And the results are in. It's Danny Walker. Looking forward to the weekend.
Okay, last time out, we dieted on the calories behind Joe Philbin and Demis Roussos's birthday cake. But today, Dennis, I hear you've got something for the weekend for us, sir.
Indeed. I noted that Monsieur Danny Walker was posting Instagram pictures of somebody about to enjoy the weekend. He's obviously looking forward to
I like the weekend.
Yeah, it's a great time of week, isn't it? I mean, it's a long weekend for you, Rob, all week, isn't it now?
Do you know what? My partner actually said that to me today. I said, oh, it's Saturday. And she sort of came out with a torrent of abuse on the line, something very similar to what you've just said there, Dennis.
How do you know which day it is? Yeah.
But the point I want to make about Danny Walker is the fact that, you know, does he, is that a, like a you know, an underlying little sort of... euphemism for like, I see this as my opportunity this year, because it was only a week ago we heard that Darryl Clark was being touted by your friend Andrew Johns to go over to the NRL.
Do you think this is his chance? Do you think this is his chance?
Mm. I think it is. And let's be honest, I mean, how old's Darryl Clark now?
48.
See, but he's getting, you know, he could be actually have peaked. If you were to plot a you know, a graph on players' performance, and I'm excluding that guy at Melbourne, then, you know, essentially, he could be actually plateauing in terms of his actual performances.
His kinetic energy is on the
again,
on the
like we were talking about with Hill and Philbin. I see the same thing happening here, and I think he sees this year as his opportunity. However, because he's got shares a name with one of my adversaries, Mr. Dan Walker, on Bit of Breakfast, I'm not too sure I could put up with that name every week, based on that alone.
Yeah, yeah. You know who sort of invented the weekend? Do you know who it was that sort of... not invented the word, the week, but, you know, who sort of gave everyone the weekend off? Henry Ford.
Ford.
He halted his production line on a Saturday and Sunday, and then that sort of started a trend, and everyone followed it.
Mm.
So the only thing I know about Dan Walker is he's a Christian. He never works Sundays on the weekend. It's the day of the Sabbath. You'll never see Dan Walker on the TV unless it's a repeat on a Sunday. Do you know Danny Walker's an anagram of?
Ooh.
And I probably wouldn't get this on Scrabble. Anal
Walker
wank.
Danny?
Anal wanked. Anal wanked, is it?
Well, you know,
admittedly,
what?
I'm using a Y on the anal, but it's anal wanked. I'll do them all next week.
Okay. Well, if he uses a different name, and that being one of them, I mean, Sam's not going to say it. He's already shaking his head, but I'm happy to put that on the team sheet.
It's time for a new section to the show. Well, I say new. We've just rebadged it. Yes, wait for it. It's coming. Yes, here it is. Lockdown. I said lockdown. Yes, lockdown. Lockdown letters. Emails. Texts. Tweets. Twitches. MySpace. Bebo. Friends reunite. Those wankers that write on walls in toilets. You know the ones. Put little dicks on the walls with a sort of hole that turns out to be a glory hole if you stick your cock through it. Not that I'd know that. Anyway, it's time for lockdown letters.
Yes, it's time for lockdown letters, everyone. Only a couple more lockdown letters to go before we have to rename the section based on the fact we'll be playing rugby league again.
Is this the last of the lockdown then?
No, we've got one more. I think we've got one more lockdown next week.
How can we work that out? Because they're playing next week.
Well, they're not, though, are they? We're not playing. We're still in lockdown.
Oh, I see. No, okay, still. Got you.
I'll be still anally wanking next week, so don't worry about it. Okay, first one's come in. He didn't actually give his name. He's a young man who works at Warrington Hospital Radio. He said, after listening to the hijack story about Demis Roussos on the podcast, I was out running, and as I went past Fletcher Street, I ran past a duffeldanger for Terry Waite. This is totally true and not made up.
Duffeldanger?
Is it duffel?
Did he have a duffel coat on and he looked like him?
He was Paddington Bear.
We've made up a new word.
Look, he said, it's totally true and it's not like Sam Statistics. So
quite right, yeah.
There we go. Yeah. Next one in, Declan Babby, he's written in. He said, I noted with great interest on the podcast last week, you ran with a Greek theme in Demis Roussos, and you also mentioned Pheidippides the Greek yes. messenger who ran from Marathon to Athens, and hence where the modern-day marathon was born. Can I congratulate Rob on his pronunciation? Oh, thank you very much. That's very nice to hear. However, I'm presuming you quoted this because there was once a Greek restaurant in Stockton Heath owned by the great man Phidippides, who played a couple of A-team games for The Wire in the 1970s when they were a player short. I always thought he was the original rugby league player with the name Fire rather than that prick, Chariots of Fire. I asked...
Ophir.
Oh, right.
Ophir.
I asked Phidippides, or Des for short, where he got his name from. He said his real name was Phidippides, but no one could pronounce it in Warrington, so he became to be known as Phidippides, or Des for short. Anyway, he says his food was pretty shit, but being a competitive Greek, he would often challenge anyone that could eat his moussaka quicker than it would take him to play Nana Mouskouri's song, Try to Remember, a prize of a special baklava, syrup shower dessert, for free. He said, I once managed to achieve this task only to hurl the syrupy cocktail back up again on the window of Buller Sports in the precinct. Oh. Although I did manage to keep the moussaka down until the Freddie Laker flight I took the next day to Gran Canaria. I entered the toilets over the British Channel and didn't reappear until we were over the Bay of Biscay. So if anyone... It says, I think Des moved back to the island of Lesbos in the early 80s. But if there's anyone out there that knows where he is, could they please get in touch with the podcast? So, Greek Desi, by the sounds of it. And the last one's come in from Stuart Hallway. He says, I'd like to complain about last week's Twitter vote in relation to the team replacing Toronto in the competition. You offered four options: Cumbria Otters, Rimmers 13, Elston's Elusive, and the Twat Gannets from Orkney. May I ask why there was so little diversity in the four options, as you were clearly offering two twats in your vote? Although one expects the Gannets have a good backbone, unlike that other spineless fucker. I don't know what's he referring to.
Oh dear, that's terrible.
I was referring to there. Okay, that's it for another week. We still have a round or two of lockdown letters, as we mentioned. If you're writing to Sam, please write in blood, stained hieroglyphics only. You can email, yes, email, apparently it's still a thing, to whatbevan@gmail.com. Tweet away to whatbevan, or if you're an anti-masker, anti-vaxxer, there's always Facebook. So with a pre-match conditioning routine ready to unleash your statistical facts in a couple of weeks' time, it's a dozen squat thrust goodbyes from Sam.
All the best.
And hoping to be able to build up from just touching his toes following his yoga class to bending over into the fetal position and sticking his cock in his mouth. It's a muffled so long from Dennis. See ya. I'm Rob London. I'm off to warm up in traditional Wilderspill style with a full English breakfast, smear myself from head to toe in wintergreen, all washed down with a glass of sherry. You've been listening to What Would Owen Bevan Say?
Listen, Rob, I really must apologise to your dad. Can you tell me he can have that Timothy Taylor's in the garage? It might have gone off, but he can have that.